The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this last week was unusual for you, to say the least, and I think you probably ought to explain to the listeners why you were actually checked out, away from the markets, away from everything, but not away from everything.
Well, I have never been on a cattle drive before. I've never pushed 2,000 head of cattle through 100,000 acres of grassland and mountain terrain.
Okay, and you haven't even seen the movie City Slickers.
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
But I was grateful to accept an invitation to go and spend the better part of a week on horseback, which I'm fairly well recovered from. But
yeah, I wondered how that went. You know, I mean, you said the first couple of days were a little bit sore. You find ways of readjusting on the saddle, and then after that, it's better?
Ibuprofen is the answer.
That's something the cowboys, I don't think, had back 100 years ago.
No, I don't think so.
All right, but you came back with some actual interesting insights. I mean, you were talking about campfires and moths and things like that, and somehow, David, you were tying it into some of the things that were going on with the Federal Reserve, and, you know, expound, if you would.
Well, I just was amazed to see these giant moths at night, and there were quite a few of them. Yeah, circling around us and every once in a while bumping up against the lanterns and whatnot. And then they just dive bomb into the fire.
Which you were charged with keeping, at least on some nights, right? Keeping
correct.
The fire going.
Correct. And I'm thinking, I realize this is natural for them to do this, but it certainly is not productive.
Right.
In fact, it's ultimately destructive, this sort of natural inclination to be drawn to the flicker,
the light.
The light, and what in this case is the flame. And I'm thinking, this is very similar to the actions of the Federal Reserve. What they're doing is by their mandate natural.
Very natural to inflate the dollar. That's what they're there for, is to actually create dollars.
And yet at the same time, what is natural can be ultimately destructive. And I think that's what we're seeing in the currency markets. I think that's what we're seeing in terms of a response to the prospect of quantitative easing 2 and a pending announcement in early November from the next FOMC meeting. In this idea that if you're going to do this, it will cost you something. And how much will it cost you? Is it like the moth dive bombing into the fire? Or is it something slightly less?
Well, you know, David, it seems that people are very addicted to the attractiveness of markets going up. I mean, look at the stock market here recently. Look at a lot of the commodities markets. There's not a feeling necessarily of recovery, but there's a feeling of pain relief, at least for a little while they're printing all this money. The problem is, we're seeing this overseas, the dollar is plummeting. And one of the reasons gold has been going up isn't because of American buying. You brought that out last week. The reason gold's going up is because everyone else actually sees that we're the moth. We're flying towards the fire, and they're going, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, whatever is natural to us is not ultimately going to be productive for them, and they don't necessarily want to participate. The question with quantitative easing, too, is what has already been baked into the cake?
Yeah, let's talk about an 11,000-point stock market right now, David.
You traditionally buy the rumor and sell the news.
Right.
And the question is, could we see a major sell-off in November? As the Fed, let's say, delivers less than the market has expected and is currently priced into asset values.
In other words, what if they disappoint?
Exactly. You've got the Dow at 11,000 currently, could be as high as 11,500 by then, maybe even 12,000. It doesn't have to go that high, but the question is, when they announce, will it be enough? Let's say, for instance, the market has calculated $1 trillion in new Fed purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fed only commits to $250 billion, which to them is still a large amount of money, but not what the market was expecting. Now your 11.5 or 12 or whatever the Dow is at those numbers is all of a sudden very, very frail. And I think, Kevin, a part of that frailty, part of what we need to remember, your business insiders, these are your corporate chiefs, CFOs, COOs, CEOs, CIOs, CTOs, the whole rest of them.
Well, whatever the acronym, these are the guys who have to report whether they're buying or selling their company's shares. Isn't that the idea of insider reporting?
Yeah, in the last 5 to 6 weeks, Kevin, have been absolutely astounding. I mean, Kevin, I'm just going to sample from last week and then just buzz through what the last 4 or 5 weeks have been as well. But last week, there was 1,169 times the insider selling as insider purchasing.
So in other words, these are guys who are selling their company's shares versus buying. It's 1,169. David, that's amazing. We've talked in the past of hundreds to one and been astounded and then watched the stock market fall afterwards. 1,169 to 1, these are the guys who should know what's coming around the corner.
My concern is that they do know what's coming around the corner, and they see deterioration in economic fundamentals. The economic fundamentals are going to lead earnings. Earnings may, in fact, be very good in the third quarter, whereas the fundamentals that support that in the fourth quarter and first and second quarter of 2011 are going to be awful. And guess what happens to the earnings as we get into 2011? And guess what happens to the share prices
sure.
that follow? So what are they anticipating? I think they know exactly where the market's headed.
Well, now, is this recent? I mean, is this just in 1 week? Is that all we're talking about?
Well,
or what are we looking at in the past?
Last week, the actual numbers, we're talking about purchases of equities by insiders. The purchases, $268,000.
Okay.
The liquidations, $334 million worth of company shares. We're talking about Oracle, Google, Marriott International, Salesforce.com.
David, these guys are running for the doors.
That's not the only issue, Kevin, because it's not just last week. The week before was 2,341 to 1. So the number was even worse the week of October the 1st, 1,411 to 1 for the week of September the 24th. So, Kevin, as we've watched the stock price, the Dow and the S&P,
it's ratcheting up.
It's moving up on low volume.
But the people who are inside are running out the door while it's happening.
Yeah, it's less than comforting, I guess you could say.
Okay, now let me ask you a question. Okay, we're not insiders, David. We just have to actually buy and sell based on what it is that we see in the news. But in the news, any person can actually look at dividend yields. They can look at price earnings ratios. We've talked about this over the last few weeks. Are they coming into line where the stock market actually looks like it could be in a bull market, or are the dividend yields and the price earnings ratios still out of whack for that?
I read a fascinating report this last week, Kevin, and it was basically that the last decade of flat to zero returns in the S&P and the Dow were utterly predictable based on the overvaluation of equities in the late 90s.
So what you're saying is it could have been seen, this last decade of virtually no return on the stock market could have been predicted just looking at the price earnings ratios and the dividend yields of the 1990s?
That's correct. And the same argument can be made today. If you're looking at valuations today, what do the next 7 to 10 years hold in terms of total returns for the Dow or the S&P? And the best estimate is that at the end of a 7 to 10 year stint, you're looking at a total return, including dividends invested, of somewhere between 3 and 5%.
And that's the predicting power of where we're at right now, looking at those numbers.
And if you go back, Kevin, even to the beginning of the last century, you're talking about Charles Dow, who wrote regularly about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow Jones Transportation Average. He argued vehemently that if stocks ever had a dividend yield of less than 3.5%, mm-hmm. you needed to let them go. You needed to sell them because you are guaranteed over the next 5 to 10 year period to see losses.
So where are we? Where are we today?
Well, I wish we had a 3.5% dividend yield on either the S&P or the Dow. Kevin, we're at about 1.97 on the S&P and about 2.57. on the Dow. So we're significantly lower, indicating that valuations in equities are too high. There is no crystal ball in investing. There is no sort of reading the tea leaves to see what happens. But you know, generally speaking, if you're buying high, you're going to lose money in the long run. And if you're buying low, you're going to make money in the long run. And the question is, are we buying high or buying low today? Today, things are overvalued. If you look at the Dow, if you look at the S&P, if you look at blue chip stocks, we're simply overpriced.
Well, and that's not inside information. That's not me knowing something about a company that I'm running. That's just simply, that's generally accessible information. And if a person doesn't know where to get it, we're telling them now.
Yeah, the interesting thing, Kevin, is that if you had sold all equities when the yields dipped below 3.5%, anytime they dipped below 3.5%, in the last 100 years, you would have sidestepped every bear market.
Mm.
Every bear market.
And that's where we're at now.
Well, the first job in asset management or for an individual investor is to don't take a major loss. You preserve what you have, protect your value. If you can see it grow, by all means, see it grow. But preservation of capital is priority number one. Growth is a secondary motive, as important as it may be. you cannot substitute number two for number one, or you may lose both.
Well, this goes back to what you've talked about in the past, David, where the biggest reason people lose money in stocks is they really lack the intestinal fortitude to do the right thing at the right time. It's not prophecy. It's just doing the right thing using the data that they have.
Well, Kevin, take the bull market that we have in gold currently. It's been 10 years, and I can tell you the number of participants in the gold market are getting more and more nervous as time goes on. It's been a good thing. Are they overstaying the bull market in gold and silver?
That was something we asked last week.
Well, exactly. And this, again, is where it does take something of intestinal fortitude, courage, or patience to see this course and stay the course until you reach overvaluation, extreme overvaluation in that market.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, Kevin, on the other side of the coin, where in a bear market, people lack the patience to wait for cheap values, and they catch the proverbial falling knife and buy too soon and see, you know, this happened in real estate in the 1980s, where you had very sophisticated investors come in and buy real estate when it had depreciated by 25-30%. It increased a good 10-15% from there. They considered themselves momentary heroes, and guess what happened next? A further 50% decline in commercial real estate in the state of Texas. So, Kevin, this is the point, is you have to let these cycles run their course, and it does take a certain amount of patience, whether you're in a bear market to stay out or in a bull market to stay in long enough for it to have been beneficial to you on a long-term basis.
So what you can say at this point, David, and I know this is not revelatory to all of our listeners, but let's just say it. Categorically, you're saying that the stock market right now is still in a bear market and is going to be until these numbers come back to reasonable figures.
The only time that I would be interested in buying equities, Kevin, is when I've got history on my side. The average dividend yield for the Dow, Kevin, is between 3.7 and 4.1% over the last 100 years. So just looking at what it is on average, and now it's 2, 2.5, whether you're looking at the S&P or the Dow.
Right.
Kevin, stocks are priced for perfection. They're priced for quantitative easing too. They're priced for Fed intervention. They're priced for something that ultimately is not going to deliver economic stabilization, because here's the problem with quantitative easing. One, it did not even deliver what it was supposed to in terms of economic stimulus. It went towards rebuilding bank balance sheets, but had very little to do with putting people back to work. And I think this is where we have a failure of expectation immediately in front of us.
Right. Well, then let's ask the question, what's already baked into the cake in the markets right now?
Kevin, if you look at the price of the Dow or the S&P, it is a foregone conclusion that both you look at equities, you look at bonds, you look at the dollar, you look at commodities, they've all reacted in the last 3 to 4 weeks to the prospect of quantitative easing, to this second quantitative easing measure being implemented in the November FOMC meeting. And that's what you see priced into the market. That's what has me concerned, is what if the Fed blinks and does less than the market expects? And frankly, if they do exactly what the market expects and offer $1 trillion into the market in terms of added liquidity, guess what?
The pricing may already be there.
That's not a catalyst for future growth. That's been priced in. That has been the cause of the movement, both in the dollar down from, you know, the 88 level, most recently from the 83, 84 level, down to 76.09. Kevin, we're breaking down in the dollar. We are breaking up in the stock market.
We talked about 3 weeks ago that this could happen, and when it did, get out. And sure enough, it happened. I think it happened the day after we did the program, David.
Well, Kevin, the problem is quantitative easing, one, didn't do what it was supposed to do. And now we're facing the mortgage mess where banks can't even substantiate the title for the house that they want to foreclose on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've gone through this period where there's been no foreclosures, and they haven't wanted to mark to market this part of their real estate book. And now, in an effort to get rid of and move some of this inventory through the system, they're finding they can't because they don't have clear docs. This is a mess. The question is the real estate market, is a rehashing of the instability in the mortgage market enough to throw water on the fires of quantitative easing, too, and disappoint even the expectation of something that may not even occur.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The banks benefited from the liquidity pouring into QE1, but that was just about it. Like you said, it didn't create a restart in the economy. David, the currency tensions that were created by this easing, by this printing of dollars, is causing this competitive devaluation worldwide. We've talked about it on last week's program, but there were a lot of tensions at the IMF meeting this weekend. The nations are angry.
Yeah, Kevin, I think that's something to keep in mind and for all of our listeners to be sensitive to. We started discussing capital controls and exchange controls back in August of 2009. And if you listen through our past programs, we did, a thorough job of looking at the reasons for currency intervention, the reasons for capital controls. In some instances, it's not, you know, keeping money inside a country, sort of the Berlin Wall, where you're trying to keep a captive audience.
It's keeping it out.
It's
keeping the other stuff out.
Exactly. Yeah. Particularly in a post-Asian contagion environment where people say, listen, the instability that was in that era was caused by hot money flowing into the region and then schizophrenically the next day leaving. And it created a tremendous amount of currency instability, and we'd rather not have the cash flows in if they're going to be cash flows out. You're seeing Brazil implement high tariffs and taxes for foreign direct investment. You're seeing India and their central bank talking about doing the same, where you are going to be a captive audience. If you're going to put money into these emerging markets, it's going to have to stay for a certain period of time, or there is a high price to pay, an extra tax for foreign investment, in order to maintain pricing stability and currency stability. They don't want hot money. They don't want hot money flows coming in or going out. Additionally, Kevin, you've got currencies which have now gotten to levels that are very dangerous in terms of exports. You look at the yen. This is a country which depends on exports. Depends on them.
Yeah, Japan has to have exports going out all the time.
Yeah, and so the yen is at all-time highs, and we've begun to see currency intervention. We've seen intervention by the Brazilian central bank. We've seen intervention by the Russian central bank. We've seen intervention by, in the last few weeks, half a dozen at least central banks. And so the issue of dollar instability, Kevin, and appreciation in these other currencies, now everyone is very, very concerned and very keen on what the impact will be to their export markets if, in fact, their currencies are getting out of control on the upside.
Well, David, would you just express in just a few short words what kind of intervention you're talking about to loosen policy or to lower the value of a currency? How is that done other than the lowering of interest rates? Because they're just about done being able to lower interest rates unless they go to negatives.
Well, one of the things that, let's say, the Japanese can do is go ahead and buy dollars, you know, to raise the value of the dollar relative to the yen.
Right.
They could also sell yen to lower the value of the yen relative to a foreign currency. So the question is, which approach do they want to take and which is least disruptive in the marketplace?
And it still goes by the moniker of competitive currency devaluation, because that's really still what it is. No matter how they intervene, they're still trying to push their currency lower so that they stay competitive.
Kevin, this week was very interesting. The meeting in Washington, D.C. with the IMF and the World Bank, and you've got a number of international central bankers, global central bankers that flew in for this meeting. And of course, Tim Geithner is back at his saying that really is the Chinese who are to blame for the world's instability. And if they would just allow their currency to appreciate, all of us could be living a happier, healthier, more stable life. So he's still sort of punting to China's the problem.
Let's use a scapegoat here.
But the issue is, there wasn't a lot of resonance with the other central bankers. Guess what happened is he's meeting with fiscal and monetary leaders at this meeting. They kind of give a nod to the Chinese, but they're now listening to the Chinese central bank, and the Chinese central bank is saying, we will not be pressured. We will not, let me repeat, will not be pressured into revaluing our currency. Thank you. You may have the chair.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Sylvester Stallone. Okay, the first couple of Rocky movies, he was powerful. I mean, yeah, he could be beaten every once in a while, but people paid attention to him. Let's face it, by the time you got to Rocky, I don't know how many there have been, but people are starting to go, okay, yeah, I think he's gotten a little bit of plastic surgery. They did quite a bit with computer graphics. Wow, isn't that amazing? That seems to be the United States. We really did swing the big bat when we were the world's driver economically, but it seems that these emerging markets, including China, are starting to replace us as far as a loud voice at the IMF and the World Bank and some of these meetings.
Well, and as we lose influence in the world's currency markets and the world's financial markets because of a loss of credibility over the last few years,
right,
guess where we go? we go to increasing pressure on the Chinese in relation to the South China Seas issue, where there's contested rights over the Paracel Islands, the Spratly Islands, and that whole region.
Isn't that interesting, David? We've talked from the beginning that it goes from the financial to the economic to the political to the geopolitical, or we could call that the strategic, because one of the key factors in our power still, frankly, is a world military that cannot be challenged at this point.
No, we still have the vast majority of aircraft carriers, the most important navy in the world, and by far the most powerful air force.
Isn't that a sign, though, of a failing empire when they have to call on their military to really make up for their financial mess?
In fact, it was one of the things that Paul Craig Roberts had said, and we mentioned in this year's DVD, we just sent out to clients about a week ago, and it was this, that one of the signs of a failed state is when you can't negotiate anymore and you have to resort to force.
Right.
And this is what I see, you know, going back to July when Hillary Clinton made the issue of the Spratly Islands a national security issue for the United States. The Spratly Islands, this is the South China Sea, and this is now a national security issue for the United States. This is called negotiation for what we want in terms of the world's reserve currency and what we want the outcome to be in terms of the revaluation of the renminbi or yuan. So it is interesting. We like to think in very strict categories, financial, economic, political, geopolitical, but the reality is these things are helpful categories through which to think through issues, but they are overlapping and intertwined, and here is where you see the economic and the geopolitical come into the same playing field.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Okay, so David, we're just a few weeks away from an election. We've got a number of things politically to be thinking about. But actually, from an economic standpoint, we're seeing more and more instability, no matter what the decision is, with the Federal Reserve, with QE1, QE2, with China, what have you. Gold and silver have been very interesting, and I think it's probably worth looking at the main motivator right now of what's pushing these markets. And, you know, comment on that, because they, since the last program, have passed very strongly past certain resistance points.
Well, I think it is fair to say that they're benefiting from the expectation of quantitative easing, too. That's one of several elements, and I think that would maybe be the key distinction between the metals markets, gold specifically, and, say, the Dow or the S&P, where that, I think, is the only thing propping them up, is the expectation of quantitative easing.
You mean the Dow is only being propped up by the expectation of QE2, whereas actually gold and silver may be going up for reasons that it is just based on the devaluation of the dollar in general.
There's two sources of energy, Kevin, in a bull market, which gold and silver are clearly in. The first is that of greed, and that's where people see the price move and they want to participate in the gain potential. This is a unique market, Kevin. Gold and silver are different than real estate. They're different than stocks. They're different than treasuries, mainly because they can benefit from both greed and fear.
Right, whereas the stock market benefits from greed, but never fear.
Right, and occasionally treasuries can benefit from fear, but very rarely greed.
Right.
So it's a rare market. Gold and silver are front and center to benefit from both strong motivating factors in the investment thesis. So you've got greed that fuels it, fear that fuels it, and I think, Kevin, I think this is where the dollar and how it is perceived internationally are feeding into that currently. You've got a monetary system, Kevin, which is now having its legitimacy questioned. It's having its functionality questioned. It's having even its morality questioned, and that is attracting a whole new audience to the metals as a currency alternative, as we've talked about in the program before.
So with the gains on gold, I mean, let's face it, people are not necessarily just running into gold based on panic or fear right now. The world's not panicking. The world's concerned. The world may be greedy on some of these markets as far as the push up, but are we getting close to a double dose where we have the greed first and then the fear, or vice versa? Where does that come in?
I think that comes in a little bit later, but we're getting a lot closer to that, Kevin. I don't know what the cusp event is that leads us into fear being a predominant factor in the purchase of metals. At this point, it's just rather prudent. You're seeing intelligent investors and big money people all over the world saying, I've done the math. The numbers don't work. They don't have the revenues to justify the debts that they have. The assets don't justify the liabilities. I'm out. I'm taking my money elsewhere. And until I find a more productive place to place my capital, I'm just going to keep it safe. You know, there's no reason to rush this. As soon as an opportunity opens up, we will invest more productively. For the time being, I'm happy to be in cash. I'm happy to be in gold. I'm happy to be in other currencies, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the movement we're seeing, Kevin.
Well, and you know, you're saying happy to be in cash, but in reality, it seems, and I may just be tracing a gut feeling here, but even a month ago, there was still strong deflationary argument worldwide that there was going to still be this huge implosion of debt. But in reality, there seems to be a shift right now into the feeling that, oh my gosh, tell me more about hyperinflation. How long does it take? I mean, even groups that you've been meeting with, they've gone from a stance where, oh, it'll never happen here, to tell me how long it takes.
Well, and Kevin, that's the thing that's hard to say. When you're talking about mild inflation of 1%, 2%, that's not something that you can even really consider in terms of how does this develop from a 2 to a 4% inflation rate.
Right.
The real concern is when you have a sociological event, when you have a cultural event where people lose confidence in a given currency, and the inflation happens on an instantaneous basis. And I know that's hard to conceive of because we think of currencies as being influenced by monetary policy, and there's a delay. You implement a policy and then you see its impact in the marketplace over the next 3 to 6 to 12 months, maybe even 18 months.
Okay, that's the monetary deflation you're talking about, where the Fed may be printing, or the Fed and the Treasury may be printing trillions at a time. And what would, in the mind of a person thinking of monetary inflation turning into hyperinflation, it would go from trillions to quadrillions or something like that.
But see, here's Kevin, where we already have the makings of a superinflation. Right now, we've got $1 trillion in excess reserves and bank balance sheets.
That hasn't gotten into the markets yet.
And another $2 trillion sitting on the Fed balance sheet. And you're talking about massive liquidity that has been created and is not fully injected into the economy. As long as the money multiplier is doing nothing, then guess what? That $3 trillion remains $3 trillion and nothing is happening with it.
Now explain the money multiplier one more time.
Well, let's change concepts and talk about velocity.
Okay.
Velocity of money is the number of times that a dollar goes through the economy.
In a given year. Yeah. Right. So if it's one or two or three times, it's...
You spend it. That vendor who, you know, you bought an espresso and they deposit it at the bank as a part of their profits for the year. And that bank lends it out and it gets spent again. That multiplying effect, that velocity, the number of times that it's coming through the system.
That takes $1 trillion to $3 trillion to $5 trillion, right?
You can have a 5 to 10 times multiplier if under normal circumstances in terms of the money multiplier. But it basically doesn't exist today.
Right.
Money that is in the banking system is not getting lent out either because people don't qualify for the loans or their personal balance sheets can't handle it.
Like water behind the dam, flood water behind a dam.
Or even the banks not being willing to lend on the basis of them realizing the losses that they have to take or perhaps are preparing to take in regards to commercial real estate, residential real estate, et cetera, and they know that they can't lend it out and they've got to hold on to it. The point is, Kevin, whatever the trigger is where that money gets into the larger economy, if there's a lack of confidence at that point, if there's a lack of confidence in the underlying currency, then you want to spend it as fast as you can because you don't want to get left holding the bag, so to say.
So actually, if the money starts getting lent, that could be a good sign that we're in a recovery, that the economy is actually moving forward.
Yeah, so you have this catch-22 where, on the one hand, liquidity has been created and it's not getting into the system.
Right.
The catch-22 is if it does get into the system and there's not a tightening of credit by the Fed, then the money multiplier takes it and you've got, instead of a $3 trillion footprint in the economy, a $15 to $30 trillion footprint in the economy.
And that turns into inflation.
That is not only inflation, but monetary super or hyperinflation. And Kevin, we have, in terms of price inflation, very different than monetary, but price inflation, we're watching commodities go nuts right now. I don't think we're at the stage where they are pricing in a devalued currency. I think they're just, you're looking at supply and demand dimensions, and you're looking at, you know, natural events. You had a fire in Russia, and so they cut off exports of their wheat. You know, that has an impact to given commodities. I mean, Kevin, if you're looking at year-over-year price increases in coffee, you're up 45%. Oranges, 35%. Pork, 68%. Sugar, 24%. Iron ore, 103%. Rubber, 62%. Palm oil, 26%. Cotton, 40%. Wool, 20%. Kevin, this is what I think the Fed is missing, is that they have supercharged the economy, and the world is set for not only competitive currency devaluation, but massive inflation, price inflation, monetary inflation, and they're still fighting a fight that doesn't exist.
Well, you know, David, businesses see oftentimes things coming long before the government does, because the government doesn't want to see it. But let's look at even UPS and Federal Express. They just announced this week that they're going to be raising their rates, and it's a whole lot more than what the reported inflation rate is.
Kevin, I realize this subjects me to criticism in terms of the broken window fallacy, but the government would be smarter if they're going to waste money as they have in the mortgage remodification programs and things like this. They'd be smarter to take $250 billion and start buying single-family homes and burning them and bulldozing them and turning them into public parks. Kevin, what they're trying to do is avoid pain, and they're doing it at the cost of structural long-term health. And it ultimately, we're going to have to pay the price. The question is, can we recover at all if they forestall the inevitable? Or can they take a more moderated approach and say, well, okay, well, it means we've got to reduce the number of houses outstanding by 100,000, by a million. Go buy a million homes and burn them down.
Well, you know, David, I know you're being tongue-in-cheek, because every time you go home, you actually have to pass bridges to nowhere that were built here in Durango. With that same mindset, which is just, let's just do something to get somebody employed. So it is tongue-in-cheek, but in reality, what we've talked about with Richard Duncan just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, he may have been scratching in areas that we never really thought of or agree with, but he was saying, look, unless there's a structural change in America, we can't compete if we can't borrow.
Going back 2.5 years, Kevin, we've looked at the increase in the adjusted monetary base and said, okay, this is going to be inflationary. There's a delayed reaction here. You increase the monetary base, and it may be 12, it may be 18, it may be 24 months, but that increase will ultimately play itself out as inflationary. And so we've gone toe-to-toe and had on the program a number of people come on and say, here's why it's deflation. Here's why it's deleveraging. Kevin, I understand there has to be an erasure of bad loans.
Right.
Okay? But that doesn't mean that we're going into monetary deflation. It means that certain banking institutions are going to go broke, and certain equity holders are going to lose, and certain bondholders are going to lose. But that still is not deflation. That is a natural business cycle where bad business bets get liquidated. Get liquidated. And guess what happens? Good business debts are then allowed to flourish. This is my point, Kevin, in terms of burning down houses. You have to allow some sort of a cycle, a liquidation cycle, to occur. And if you don't, whatever money you are spending is to perpetuate something that ultimately cannot be sustained.
And the collapse
anyways
is far more resounding at the time, because you didn't experience the pain. We all understand that with life. Life is that way. You have to address the pain.
And that was Duncan's point a few weeks ago, saying if you're going to spend the money, which I don't necessarily agree that we should spend the money, but if you're going to spend it productively, don't flush it down the toilet. And by the way, we are in a depression. This is not a recession. If you take away the budget deficit, what the government is spending to fill the hole that the private sector used to spend, we have 12% declines in GDP, not 2% declines in GDP or 3% declines in GDP, and we're smack dab in the middle of what 1929 looked like. Bloomberg, just this last week, is running numbers that, yeah, actually, if you do factor in those who've quit looking for jobs, yes, they're unemployed, but not technically, because they've quit looking for work, I guess we're close to 20% unemployment.
Yeah, and
Bloomberg,
this is Bloomberg.
This is right. Bloomberg. See, Kevin, I think the realities are forcing themselves into people's consciousness, and the room for political and sociological unrest are growing. You know why? Because when inflation, as we just mentioned, coffee 45, barley 32, oranges 35%, beef 23%, and gonna go higher, a lot higher on beef because corn's going up. And yet the cost of living adjustment from Social Security is not going up. So now you've got tens of millions of Americans who are saying, I don't know why I'm frustrated.
I don't know why I'm not making it to the end of the month with the money that I have.
Because I'm being told that there's no inflation, and yet I run out in week 3.
Right.
I can't make it to the end end of the month, which means I've got to go into debt just to make things work or spend principal from my savings. And I'm very uncomfortable about this. This is what's happening, Kevin. This is what's happening across the country. And it's what makes November totally up for grabs.
Yeah. Well, David, you talk about the social unrest that this could cause, and people are becoming uncomfortable. Again, they're not necessarily panicking because the dollar still buys things. But when the dollar stops buying things, or when they see that the government really doesn't have an answer, I mean, there are states right now that are saying to Washington, hey, what you guys have done is unconstitutional. It's not something that we're going to follow in suit with. And so they're actually starting to repel federal laws.
Kevin, there's an interesting book written by a professor at Stanford called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And he lays out those three options where either on the basis of loyalty, you have consensus and maintain consensus, or people are upset about some particular policy, and if they have an adequate voice, that may mean that you keep consensus or an agreeable group together.
So it stays civilized.
Yeah, you stay civilized as long as they have an adequate voice, and they will use it. Mm-hmm. If they don't have a voice, and there's not adequate loyalty, then the only option is exit. And you look at the state attorney generals across the country saying, wait a minute, whether it's health care or this option or that option that's being implemented in D.C., what's good for the D.C. goose is not necessarily good for our state gander. And perhaps that's what's going to change in November. Kevin, we're just trying to wrap our minds around it. I don't know that we have yet, but we'll try to explore some of those ideas in terms of constitutionality of current laws, states' rights, things of these issues, which, again, we may or may not be advocates of, but we want to see how this plays out and what people choose. Is it exit? Is it voice? Or is it loyalty?
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.